welcome to episode 135 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other revolutionaries as masterpieces. I am Nick, the downtrodden working class of this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
I guess that makes me the Cossacks shooting on the steps. Never mind.
Fiend. I didn't open with a quote for this one because I can neither speak Russian nor do much of a quote from a silent film, because we are talking one of our earliest, not actually our earliest, I don't think, was Nosferatu before this, or was this the actual earliest?
No, the earliest we've done is Caligari in 1920.
Oh, of course. Okay, so this is a whole 5 years later. We are discussing a purported masterpiece and badly pronounced by me, at least, Battleship Potemkin.
Or Potemkin, as would have been pronounced at the time, more or less.
That sounds much nicer, actually. I will fail to do that, but it does sound much nicer. So this is a silent movie, a propaganda movie, I think it's fair to say.
This, I think, is our first banned film.
Because it was banned in the UK?
Yeah, I think this is the first one that's actually refused certification.
Now, is this because of graphic violence or because it was propaganda?
Well, it's complicated. The BBFC basically said films should not address this issue of political controversy, which was perhaps more plausible in 1925 than later. But because of the slightly complicated system for this, they did try it. Exporters did try this, a few local councils as well. And they basically said, no, too much graphic violence.
Okay, so they lost on both counts.
And then the filmmaker said, well, we could cut it. No, too much graphic violence. Then the police visited the distributors and had a quiet word with them. And there were private showings, which is, of course, perfectly legal. Yeah, if it's not for public exhibition. And even those were sometimes broken up by the police. This was clearly regarded as dangerously hot stuff that will obviously ignite the fires of revolution among the working man.
Oh, it'll never happen. But now, it was banned for many years, though, wasn't it? It wasn't just like around 25.
Until 1954, it was resubmitted. Finally. And basically, two things have happened by that point. One, even the British market agrees that silent films are no longer commercially viable.
Yes.
And two, Stalin is dead.
I was going to say, 1954, obviously, everything had calmed down and we were friends with the Russians again by then.
So it got an X rating then.
Well, it is quite. Let's launch into a bit. So this is a historical epic, not nearly as epic it was supposed to be, because I understand it. This film was supposed to be, it really was filmed as propaganda, basically. It was to celebrate the huge revolution of 1905.
Yeah. So basically the 20th anniversary of that revolution, which looked at in the broad sense, didn't actually achieve all that much in that the Tsarist government was still there afterwards. On the other hand, it had shown how weak that government was.
Yeah, it probably set up the tables for the 17 revolution. I got there in the end.
Well, but, yeah, as usual with history, it's all a lot messier than you can say, oh, dates X to Y, then it happened and then it has happened and so on. So, yeah.
Yes, history is always a bit messier, indeed, than it is portrayed here. But I think the original idea to celebrate 20 years of the first revolution was to have this huge epic of the revolution, the first revolution against the Tsar all across Russia, but it got scaled down quite a bit. I don't think, as far as I understand it, just because he ran out of time, the director.
Yeah, basically, this is Mosfilm. They handed it to Eisenstein, who was at that point a young and relatively inexperienced, but, well, we'll see how good he was, director. And he started filming the first section of it, and it rapidly became clear that this was not going to be done by the end of the year, and it kind of had to be done by the end of the year, because, you know, big anniversary.
Yeah, the 21st anniversary, no one's that excited about.
Yeah, I mean, similar problems were made with Windows 95. I mean, once it was called 95, it had to be released in 95.
That's probably why they stopped doing that now.
I know people who were taken off working on bugs specifically because they needed to hit the release date. So
genius.
Yeah, anyway. So yeah, this was originally a tiny part of that big script here. The script was basically, here are, I don't know, 8 incidents that were each individually key parts of the revolution, and this was the one that survived.
Yes, this is the one that became most, I don't know, had they started filming this portion? I don't think so. I think they just cut the script down to took out one bit of the script and then expanded that.
Yes.
So this is the true, though, true dot 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 story of the battleship.
True.
I got the impression. So it's divided into 5 acts, which is a bit unusual. And the first act, men
more
and maggots.
More usual for the time. I mean, remember, this is the early days of film. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I suppose I'm used to a 3-act structure, but this is... So the first part is men and maggots, and it's the revolution is raging across Russia, or starting across, or everyone's talking about revolution, and in some places it's happening against the Tsar, against the White Army. Were they called the White Army? But the Tsar's, Tsarist forces anyway.
The army. Really.
The army. That's true. Yes. Yeah. And we have the crew of the battleship, Potemkin, who are talking about it, and we're really seeing this from a kind of a below decks perspective, if you like. We're seeing it from the low ranking men, the revolutionaries, the fine upstanding core of the revolution, morally superior to the decadent officers in it.
Well, in particular, we have two sailors. Let's see.
Vakulinchuk.
Yep. We'll come back to them, but they are our, insofar as we have an identification character, they are probably it, though. It's pretty loose in terms of viewpoints anyway.
It is. It's interesting. The films that we've picked from the 20s, which would be Nosferatu, Caligari, and this, have all got very distinct visual styles, I would say. Obviously, there's the dramatic expressionism of Caligari. We have the incredible high-contrast visuals of Nosferatu. Here, I was very quickly struck by the kind of the pace of it, the sentiment. It's interesting, because you don't really get any... not in this part. Anyway, a lot of sort of tracking shots where there's actual movement. But what you get is a bit sort of Adam Curtis style montage of things, but they give you the sense of movement, which may be a technical limitation at the time that we didn't get movie shots. But it certainly felt to me very quickly, very dynamic and fast-moving.
Well, remembering if we step forward a few years, the 1932 Most Dangerous Game.
I love that film.
Where we've got that one shot of the moving camera pushing through the foliage, and that was considered, you know, the audience would go, wow, how did they do that? Seven years after this.
Quite some time before Steadicam was a thing.
The camera's on tracks, but even that was quite a, these are big, delicate pieces of machinery. Any sort of jolt will just cause the film to jump its tracks or a cog to jam or whatever.
Which is, yeah, so with those limitations, the kind of montage of... and a real focus on detail that put me slightly in mind of Das Boot, because it's... we really are on a battleship here. This isn't a stage. They are cramped in these quarters. We're seeing the machinery and the cooks and... the sleeping quarters, and that's sometimes contrasted with the, not very often, but with the captain's quarters, and the way they move around the ship, you know, just clambering over the guns. It's just all very, you get a real sense of the space they're in.
Yeah, when they're setting out the food, which we'll come back to, the swinging tables are set up.
Yes.
Because this room is used for other things at other times.
Yeah, you can't have a mess hall all the time. This is a temporary. Yeah, it was. So I loved all that kind of visual yeah, dynamism, I think. It felt very different to the two sort of horror films we've seen from this era. Mm. I mean, this is from obviously a regime that's celebrating its industry and power, and it does come across.
It also helps that they had an actual battleship to film on. Not this one, not even one of the same class, but one right. of broadly the same type that would not have been wildly different.
Yes, Potemkin's ending was a bit less noble, I think, as far as I can tell.
Oh, this one, it was available because it had been scuttled 5 years earlier, but they scuttled it in shallow water as part of a defensive manoeuvre, and so the superstructure was still above water until the ship was scrapped 5 years after this. So
did they refloat it for this?
No, this is the Rostislav. She was sitting on a sandbank, basically. And they did some moderately clever camera work. Most of the long shots are stock footage.
Some of that works. Like, you can see some are model shots as well, in the way that, unfortunately, model shots with water, it's not really a thing anymore, but you can very quickly see the proportions of ripples and boats are just out of whack, and you can tell it's a model very quickly, which is not really a problem anymore. But otherwise, visually, it's really dynamic.
Absolutely.
And engrossing. I can see why, you know, cinematographically, it's hard to say cinematography, well, not literally, it's hard to say, but it's hard to say there's a lot of cinematography in the sense that we mean it with moving shots, but the way the shots are set up is fascinating. And it's also, I don't know, it's a bit, with films this old, you know, you're aware that everyone you're looking at and everything and everyone that was involved in it is now dead. And it's fascinating to see these visual artifacts of history.
A thing actually that this has in common with the Das Boot is Eisenstein, rather than using professional actors, mostly went and looked for people who looked right and said, okay, you know, you guys could, at least you guys could be in the crowd scene.
Yes. Now, modern films do that sometimes, but yeah, it particularly works well with silent films where, you really just, you want the look of the thing. So the story is, that there's discontent on the ship already. Then they get this consignment of meat, or they have meat that's there already, which is crawling with maggots. They bring this to the attention of the officers, and the ship's doctor basically tells them they're not maggots, they're insects. You can wash those off with salty water. And basically tells them to go on and cook it. They make borscht out of it, but the sailors then refuse to eat it. They don't make a big process of it. They just don't eat it. They eat the associated bread and water and stuff like that. But
canned goods out of stores, that kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. But they're not going to eat the borscht, which upsets the officers and leads to the second act, drama on the deck. Now, the first part of this, I wanted to see how much was accurate. Pretty much all of this actually happened on board the Potemkin, as far as I could tell.
With one deviation, which we'll get to.
Okay, but this first part, including the doctor passing it as fine meat and eat it.
And certainly they are threatened with being shot.
So in the second part, which is drama on the deck, basically they're called up by the officers and say, right, who doesn't want to eat the borscht? Okay, anyone who didn't eat the borscht is now going to be shot. Well, he actually says, I'm going to hang you all from the yardarm. Then they bring up a huge tarpaulin to cover them.
Is the thing that was different. And the way it's done in the film, and it's very dramatically effective, is basically it's draped over their heads so that they can't see what's happening.
Yes.
What was actually done, which was actually much more common, was it's laid out on the deck. Because remember, these are wooden decks. And even with a lot of scrubbing, you're not going to get the blood out.
Oh, okay. But visually, it is quite dramatic to see these men huddled under this tarpaulin waiting to be shot. And that's when Vakulinchuk basically foments the revolution. He stands up, says, enough's enough, brothers, you're with me, and starts a revolution on board the Potemkin. Most of the officers are either killed or thrown aboard, or both. Vakilinchuk is killed in the fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, there we go, we have the first, well, not the, I don't know if this is the first People's Revolutionary Battleship. My vague understanding of history is I think all the battleships were supposed to do it, and not all of them did.
Yeah, well, yeah, we should, okay, with the proviso, as always, that this is not a history podcast. And people keep saying, why do you do history? I don't do a history podcast, damn it.
maybe you should do a history podcast, Robert.
But a lot of, I mean, there was socialist revolution and various factions fomenting it in general. But the particular thing that brings this at this particular time is the Russo-Japanese War. So basically all the more experienced officers and crews had been sent off to the east.
And spoilers, that doesn't go so well for the Russians.
Yeah, and just before all this happened, the news of the Battle of Tsushima Strait had reached Russia. And it was a profound defeat.
It was a humiliation for the Tsar.
For a variety of reasons. I mean, the crews were less experienced. They didn't have central fire direction. The Japanese had better use of telegraphy between ships.
This is after that. Again, this is a fascinating period of history where the Japanese have basically decided maybe we shouldn't stay in the medieval period for the whole time and modernized at a pace I don't think ever rivaled by any other nation on earth, where they move from a medieval feudal system to basically an industrial nation in a very short order. Nothing to do with this film.
There are some lovely Japanese anime with a steampunk idea, and when they do Japanese steampunk, it tends to be set about this sort of era.
Right, yes, yeah.
Because, you know, huge pace of technological development and so on. But, yeah, as you say, not really relevant. So, you know, Russia's just been humiliated on the world stage, and that's a big part of this.
And particularly, I guess, the Tsar has been humiliated on the world stage. We have this revolution. So what, did the other ships revolt? I got the impression there was a big plan for other battleships, all the battleships to revolt. They didn't.
Didn't happen.
Okay.
So yeah, historically what we get at this point is, yay, we've got a battleship, now what do we do?
Yeah, I feel at this point the film really does start to deviate from reality after the revolution of the battleship, which it's pretty close to reality up until then.
Well, it's quite selective, at the very least.
Okay, yes.
But, yeah, I mean, they go to Odessa. This is all happening on the Black Sea, which I don't think was actually mentioned, but, that's basically where it's all going on. Okay. Vakulinchuk's body is taken ashore and becomes an instant shrine.
Yes, they leave him on, at least in the film, they leave him on the dock with a slip of paper that says, for want of some borscht, I was shot, or something along those lines.
Yeah. A nice little point here is, obviously this would have been, everything would have been done with the full approval of the party. So what we have here is an agitator who's saying, and we know who's really to blame for this, it's the Jews.
Yes.
And the crowd shouts him down. Whereas, of course, the actual Bolsheviks were entirely happy to say, yep, it's the Jews, all right.
Well, that's the interesting, yes, it's, they don't so much shout him down as beat him down. But yes, it's, that was an interesting moment. I wasn't sure quite what it was. I think the problem there is, because I know what the actual history was like, I wasn't sure quite what it was trying to do. But I guess the point is, this was showing the ideal of communism rather than the actuality of government. I mean, we still had
he is meant to be a Tsarist agent, but it's not particularly clear from the film.
Okay, so he's supposed to be fomenting trouble in there. Trotsky was involved a lot in this kind of until he was airbrushed from history, but I think he had a lot to do with this kind of propaganda. But again, an aside. But yeah, so the people of Odessa basically decide to revolt, but it's kind of a quiet revolt.
It's rioting, basically.
It is rioting, and crucially, they sail out to the Potemkin and give them food and succor, I suppose you would call it. And that is enough to really annoy the Tsar and his troops, who then we lead to this famous scene, which is kind of, one of the most famous scenes in cinema history. I think the Odessa Steps, which is where the kind of robot-like, dispassionate Tsarist army just
specifically slowly... Cossacks, because like any sensible empire, you sent to keep order in province A, people from province B a long way away.
Your province Z, I suppose, in this case. Yeah. But they march and ride down the steps, basically mowing everyone down on the way. And this is a really, it's a really visceral, quite graphic. So when we talked about graphic violence, that this is where it comes, really. We get, in a way, it's made more, or it feels more graphic than perhaps it is, because certainly we've seen more dramatic stuff. But, the close-ups of the faces with broken glasses and blood pouring down their eyes, and children getting shot, mothers getting shot holding their children. The famous scene of the pram rolling down the steps, mm-hmm. Because the mother's been shot, which has been parodied many times in the past, particularly in the Untouchables has it.
Yeah, I think that's where I first saw it.
I also saw it re-parodied in The Naked Gun 33 and a third, where a man's lawnmower rolls down the stairs. It's a very, I don't know, it feels dynamic. The move at this kind of implacable enemy marching down the steps, and then the crew of the Potemkin then fire at Odessa and destroy parts of the city. Or at least the Odessa. So it's dramatic cinematography, as a piece of cinema. It is incredible. I just found it.
I'm particularly impressed. I mean, obviously, it's a technical limitation of the era, but it is shot in daylight, and I think a lot of more modern films, even though they could shoot in daylight, would make this in the dark, and you know, it's dark and it's scary, and it's perhaps there's smoke swirling around and that sort of thing. And there's nothing like that. This is actually happening. There are these guys at the top. There is these other guys at the bottom. There is no way to escape except maybe playing dead if you're lucky.
Yes, it really gives this sense. It's kind of, I was slightly reminded of the Terminator, this implacable, unstoppable, unsympathetic enemy. It's just utterly dehumanizes the Cossacks. And it's really dramatic. Never happened, because...
Well, it's unclear. I mean, there was rioting all over the city,
yes,
certainly.
Okay.
And there were certainly incidents where the Cossacks did simply fire into the crowd with the aim of killing as many of them as possible. Probably didn't actually happen on the steps, but it's just not clear at this point.
Yes, but it is sort of deviating from the truth slightly. But yeah, okay, it's true to the spirit of the thing. And then the Potemkin, I think this did happen, then opens fire on Odessa.
Well, technically, yes. It is presented as, yeah, we will heroically use the battleship to fire on the, I think it's the Opera House, where the Tsarist military headquarters has been set up, and this will prevent any further massacre.
Yes.
In fact, they fired two shells and missed.
Okay.
So it can fairly be said that they did not in fact affect the course of the massacre.
Okay. So they may have caused it in the first place.
Even if it was connected in time, which it's not clear that it was. Much of the port area was destroyed by fire. You get riots, you're always going to get fire.
Yeah.
And so
can't have a good riot without seeing fire to something.
No, the actual firing was in response to, I think, to the demonstration that was building up around the funeral. So soldiers tried to break that up, and that was when the shooting back happened. So, yeah.
Well, then we have the final scene of the film, which really starts to kind of creep into fantasy. Well, not quite. I mean, I think something similar did happen.
Mm.
But we have one against all. I was surprised to see this quote, because they do actually say one for all and all for one. And I suppose Dumas had written The Three Musketeers by then. I just wasn't expecting to see it in a Russian propaganda film. But the spirit of it is that... the Navy has now been sent against the, or the Tsarist fleet has been sent against the Potemkin, and the Potemkin decides to just sail through it and hope that they won't get shot, hope that everyone doesn't shoot them. And it's a really good, because I didn't know the history, I didn't know, I assumed it was going to end with the battleship getting sunk. So it was like, there's a real tense build up of everyone getting more and more anxious as they sail through, and people feeling that. I mean, as a propaganda film, it is quite, you know, it does show the human side of these people and their fear. Mm. And it's not, well, it is totally one-sided, but they're not superhuman. You know, they're not, they do feel human emotion. They feel fear. They feel anger. They're not never touched by doubts. And none more so than this final bit where they're going to sail through and they have a restless night's sleep and we're kind of with them. And then they finally meet the fleet, and they're all ready to fire, and the Tsarist fleet doesn't fire on them, and they sail off to a glorious revolutionary future.
Yeah, this did more or less happen. One of the Tsarist captains attempted to ram and then blow up his magazines, but his senior officers prevented him from doing that.
Okay.
But yeah, that kind of happened.
Okay, so actually, I was thinking it kind of deviates into fantasy. Most of this film, then, one way or another, actually happened. Again, I don't know why we're comparing it, except because it's a propaganda film and because it is telling the story. And I keep calling it a propaganda film, but that's because it was made by and approved by the state and released, really, as look how great our glorious communist state is. So it really is propaganda. I mean, it certainly influenced people like Himmler, the power of cinema. Mm. and what you could do with it. So it's interesting to see how accurate it is from a slightly selected point of view. What
yeah,
happened to the Potemkin after that?
That's the thing.
Glorious.
And they had also captured a military transport. So they set off. They set off for Constanta on the Romanian coast. This is further down the Black Sea. But if we say Odessa is about sort of 11 or 12 o'clock, Constanta is about 9 o'clock round the sea. So they went there in the hope that they would be able to restock food and water and coal. And the Romanians said no. Also, we have a small protected cruiser here, which is at least going to give you a fight. They went for they went for a smaller port, Theodosia in the Crimea. The city's governor said no. The mutineers tried to steal several barges of coal and lost 22 out of 30 sailors because they were ambushed by the port's garrison. They went back to Constanta. This is now 7th of July, so to 3 or 4 days after the mutiny. The Romanians basically said, all right, if you disarm yourselves and surrender the battleship, we will give you asylum from the Russians, which they took. I think the military ship went back to Sevastopol to turn themselves in. Potemkin's crew took the terms. Matuchenko ordered the Kingston valves to be opened so that the ship would be sunk.
Right.
But didn't do a great job of it because, well, we'll get back to that. Basically, the Russians turned up within a few days, refloated the ship. She was back in Russian service by October with a new name.
So, not quite the glorious future that we have at the end of the episode. It's a fascinating episode in history and a period of history, but not as ever. You know, you can make it a happy ending as long as you end the story at the right time.
Well, yeah, Matuchenko, who is portrayed as this great revolutionary leader. He went on to live. He lived in Romania, moved to Switzerland, moved to the States. He met various revolutionary leaders, including Lenin and Maxim Gorky. Basically, various people have tried to claim various political views for him, but he doesn't really seem to have been apolitical at all.
Right, okay.
I mean, he didn't like the bad treatment and he wanted to do something about it. That's about it.
But he didn't have a sort of broader grand plan, which didn't really fit in with the Bolsheviks' idea, I guess.
Yeah, and in June 1907, he went back to Russia under a false name and was arrested, and he was hanged in November 1907. So there's a happy ending for everyone.
God, okay. Well, then he becomes a martyr to the glorious cause, I guess. So, we've said it a few times already. As a film, I mean, to me, I wasn't quite expecting it to be so dynamic. And, you know, as a piece of cinema, I can absolutely see why this is an utter masterpiece. I mean, it is, it's incredible to watch, and it is gripping. I was gripped at the end when they were sailing through the fleet. So as a work of cinema, I think it's fantastic. As a kind of narrative, I can't help be coloured by, you know, what came after, and the Bolsheviks particularly. So I suppose the way I put it, and the way I put it sort of off air, is I think this is a very easy film to admire. It's a hard film to kind of love or even particularly like, in a way that there's not really any heroes here, there's no, and it's actually about quite
well. To be fair, that would be one of the socialist points, that the individual hero doesn't matter as much as the mass movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I can't help but see that from the perspective of, you know, where that mass movement led to with Stalin in the 30s and 40s.
But I mean, that's why, I mean, yeah, we have these two guys as the faces of the mutineering sailors. But it seems pretty clear that they are not in charge of it.
Yes. And they're, you know, as you say, the movement is the important thing. And it's
Lovely side bit. When we get the ship's chaplain in to try to calm the men down, and he's not only with his wild hair, but there's always smoke behind him and flame.
That was I feel like that scene has been parodied quite dramatically as well. But it's an arresting image. But I don't, to the point of feeling a bit.
Tell us, Mr. Eisenstein, your opinions on the Russian Orthodox Church.
It was so. As a piece of cinema, as I say, it's incredible. As a narrative, what it does is make me interested in the real history, which is why this is why we've been referencing the whole history the whole time. The real, if there is such a thing as the real history, but there's certainly. I know truth is a double-edged sword, but there's certainly things that are more true than others, and it's interesting to see the whole truth as much as we can throughout historical documents. I suppose what I'm dithering around is spoilers. I mean, absolutely, this film is a masterpiece of cinema, but it's I didn't flat out enjoy it as much as I enjoyed Caligari or Nosferatu.
It is very obvious from the first few minutes that this is a film with a message.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I think is fairly usual, but it's possibly worth mentioning in this context, this is 1920s early film, and the default mode is let us take a stage play and put a camera in front of it.
Yes.
And everywhere where that's not happening, that is an innovation by Eisenstein, even if it looks quite normal to us.
Well, that's what I was surprised. Yes, we are used to these kind of... And I talk about that, you know, these different films from the 20s we've seen, and they're all kind of experimenting with different ways of cinematography. But this montage sort of style here of things moving quickly in industry and... It slightly reminded me, I think you mentioned it off air as well, of our recent watch of All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, that kind of montage of different images. There are other ways of making things feel dynamic in cinema now, particularly moving cameras. Maybe in our next episode we'll talk about something that does that masterfully as well. But... Yeah, it's a fascinating one. I was surprised at how well that style of basically static images, but montaged together of a lot of moving things, like different images of the pram going down the steps to give this sense of... I had to watch it again because I thought, oh, there must be a tracking shot of watching the pram go down. No, there isn't. It's just a lot of different still images, not still images, but static images.
Yeah.
But it really does give this sense. Working with what Eisenstein had to work with, it's a really good piece of cinema.
And of course, as we said a while ago with Red Cliff, when you're working for a totalitarian regime, you are not short of extras.
So. That's true. And there is a great scene of the whole dock and the wall to the Black Sea, absolutely full of people just crowding around this or heading towards, queuing up to see the dead body of Vakulinchuk,
yeah.
It's, as a piece of cinema, it's breathtaking. As a piece of propaganda, I could kind of see why it was banned, because it does give you this sense of glory. Yeah, up the workers. As a narrative.
In an era when film is generally regarded as harmless entertainment.
Yes. I think this is, it shows the power of film to motivate. And, you know, as far as I've already spoiled whether I think it's a masterpiece or not, but as far as, you know, was it influential is one of our queries, questions for masterpieces. I mean, it was. So many people were influenced by it. One of our Ribbon of Memes favourites, Billy Wilder, I believe, said this was his favourite film. But it was when you've got scenes that are parodied, and then parodied again, and then parodied again. You know, like the priest, like the Odessa Step scene. That, you know, that's a parody is a the sincerest form of flattery in film, at least. Mm.
Yeah, in terms of the political thing, let us not forget 1915, The Birth of a Nation, a.k.a. D.W. Griffith does Yay, the Ku Klux Klan.
Yorks.
Which, yeah. I mean, so political film was there. But, you know, when it's white guys saying, ain't it great to be a white guy, it feels less political to other white guys.
That is a very good point. Yes.
I do just want to get in Roger's Naval History Corner, because Potemkin was not a bad design for a battleship of the era.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that she was launched in 1903, and she was made... In 1906, along comes HMS Dreadnought, which was sufficiently influential on naval tactics that all ships of this era were retroactively called pre-dreadnoughts.
Okay, but basically obsolete by this new invention.
Yeah, and basically what she has is two twin 12-inch gun turrets, which are the ones we mostly see, and, you know, 16 6-inch and 14 3-inch and 6 1.9-inch, and a bunch of torpedo tubes. And the theory is that you use the long-range guns at long range, and then you use the short-range guns to deal with the torpedo boats and stuff that get in close.
Mm.
And it was rapidly becoming clear that, A, you fire both sets of, you know, two sets of guns at once, you can't tell from the, you can't observe the fall of shot because you don't know which splashes are from which guns.
Okay.
But also, B, if you've got long-range guns, you can blow away the torpedo boats at long range. So you don't need the little guns because they're never going to get that close.
Don't worry about it. Okay, yeah, all right.
And that's basically the revolution that Dreadnought brings on. Also, this is one of the last... Okay, it took a bit longer. This is, as we see in several engine room shots, this is a reciprocating steam engine. multiple expansion design. Whereas it was becoming pretty clear... It had been clear for some time, but it took a while to be adopted, that steam turbines were the future.
I'm very glad you exist, Roger. The world would be a...
So yes, HMS Dreadnought, of course, also had steam turbine.
Okay.
So, it's... In terms of retroactive, you know, this seemed really great at the time, but later... This is another instance of that.
Yes,
didn't look all that great from 5 years retrospect. The ship, I think,
I suppose, was much like battleships look once you had aircraft carriers and things.
Yeah. I can't remember when the ship was actually scuttled, but before the Second World War, certainly.
Oh, yeah, I think it was... Yeah.
I mean, she'd been scrapped before this film was shot in 1923.
Now, I suppose the other thing, we often talk about the soundtrack, the thing about Battleship and a lot of films of this era was they didn't come with a soundtrack. You supplied your own with the music. What kind of music did you have for your version of Potemkin?
There have been attempts to do it with the original score. I think the one I've seen was the Shostakovich.
Yes, that's the one I saw as well, yes, yeah. Which worked pretty well.
There is an original score by Edmund Meisel. Eisenstein was hoping that the score would be rewritten every couple of decades to keep it up to date with current trends in music.
Well, I think people have made attempts at that, yeah. Because it has been fun. There's even an avant-garde jazz soundtrack, which might not be my cup of tea, but there you are. The soundtrack, Shostakovich, worked well for this particular...
I mean, it's roughly contemporary, and yeah. At least the one I saw, there was a bit of effort to put things in with, you know, timing it with the guns firing and that kind of thing, so...
I suspect we watched the same version then.
Yeah.
Well, there we are. We haven't asked you, Roger. Do you think Battleship Potemkin is a cinematic masterpiece or a damp squib?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't throw it randomly at a modern audience. I do think it needs to be looked at in the context of this is what people were expecting from film at the time and this instead is what they got.
Fair enough, yes.
But especially on that basis, yes, absolutely.
And should it have been banned in the UK for 20-plus years?
Well, let's build an alternate history where, you know, violent revolution breaks out in 1927. More successfully than the historical ones.
Yes. I don't know. When was Mosley? He was in the 30s, wasn't he?
No, socialist revolution.
Oh, of course. Sorry. Well, socialist in the name. Anyway.
Just one final note. Because we've missed a few weeks recently, we're going to try going for a 2-week schedule rather than 1 week.
Yes, we may get the odd one out sooner, but I in particular am slightly struggling with a weekly schedule, and we have missed a few. So we'll probably officially go to every other week, but if we manage to get one out weekly,
we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Use the RSS feed, it's the simple way.
And dos vidania, comrades.